Hey, I'm Alan McGuire.
And I'm Sarah Griffin.
And this is Juvenalia, a podcast where we talk to an interesting person about a bit of pop culture that was important to them when they were young. Our guest today is novelist Amy Clarkin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Very exciting. You've picked a gigantic topic. I should say up front, normally when someone gives us a TV show that we haven't seen before, they will recommend like 4 or 5 episodes, and then we'll watch those and try like hook the episode around that. I've watched 25 episodes of this now because I like it so much.
Oh my God. So, I've only watched the 4.
Yeah.
But I already suspect that this is going to ruin my life in a pretty major way, even from coming out the outskirts. It's enormous.
Yeah. So Amy, please tell us, what have you picked?
Yes. So I've picked Avatar: The Last Airbender, which is one of my favorite TV shows. I watched it from when I was about 14 to 17 for the first time. It was airing on Nickelodeon, so I used to come home after school and before I did my homework, watch my episode of Avatar. And I just adored it. And it's one of those shows I keep coming back to and keep rewatching. And every time I do, I take something new from it. So I'm really excited to get to nerd out about it for the next while.
So for anybody who only knows it as a thing they scroll past on Netflix because it looks like a cartoon they're not interested in, what is Avatar actually about?
Okay, so I feel like I'm about to do the intro from the episodes.
It's very
long ago, the four nations lived in harmony. So it is set in a fictional world where there are 4 different nations, the Earth Kingdom, the Fire Nation, the Water Tribes, and the Earth Temples. And they all used to live in harmony. And then the Fire Nation attacked and took over the other 3. So there's one person, the Avatar, who can master all 4 elements and bring peace, but he vanished 100 years ago. And the show starts with 2 water tribe teenagers, I think they're about 14 to 16, finding the new Avatar, a 12-year-old boy in the iceberg, and they have to help him master all 4 elements and take down the Fire Lord. I think that is probably the easiest way to describe it.
And that feels like a very, like, almost like a video game kind of set of objectives, but it's like maybe the deepest kid show I've ever watched.
It feels like a political drama from I tend to watch things normally beginning to end. I'm not a person who can just hop in and out normally, but in this case I was like, right, we'll just come in face value and watch the prescribed episodes. But it is enormously complicated in a way that feels like very rich and very engrossing. So it's also, there's 2 shows, right? There's The Last Airbender, and then there's another one that is really popular, which
the Legend
is
of Korra.
The Legend of Korra, which I feel like I've seen a fair amount of Tumblr. My Tumblr landscape occasionally intersects with Legend of Korra stuff as well. And it is about young people as well, crucially. It feels like a political drama where the young people, we are learning about the deep, complicated national histories of these 4 tribes via their children.
Yeah, and I think definitely for me, watching it when I was younger, and even now, the depths of the topics, like you were saying, Alan, that they go into, I mean, they're talking about colonialism, indoctrination, propaganda, genocide, like all through a children's show that still manages to be light and wholesome and really hopeful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really impressive thing. Like, they managed to walk that line between the depth and darkness and the lightness and the hope so beautifully, that I think for a lot of people watching, especially for me at the age I was, I mean, I was blown away by it. I think that's why it's still something I come back to so much, like especially Prince Zuko, the fire child.
Yeah,
the fire prince, the banished prince, whose destiny, he can only regain his honor by capturing the Avatar. And his character arc over 3 seasons is him having to come to terms with being part of a colonial power and realizing that actually maybe everything he's been taught from a young age is not right. And that, to me, seeing his journey and how he wrestles with that, it is so powerful. I think he's probably my all-time favorite character in any TV show, maybe apart from Catra in She-Ra and the Princesses of Power.
Poor old Catra.
Oh, poor Catra. She is such a time. But I think there's a lot of similarities between 2 of them. But yeah, it's just one of those shows where I cannot get over how sensitively and movingly they manage to deal with such deep topics and then introduce them in such a friendly way to people, almost. It's really impressive.
the Zuko stuff is really interesting because one of the episodes that you gave us as like a recipe for this episode is specifically about that struggle that he has with this inherited power. Like, and that was my first kind of exposure to this, was this episode about Zuko. It's episode season 2, episode 8, I want to say, where we see him on this solo journey and we see a little bit of what led him to this. Like, he sort of struck out of the tribe. I feel like his mother killed his grandfather. Like, there's a lot of like high level, if this was played by a live action cast, this would be gnarly stuff. Like, 100% not a children's television show. The only bit in it that I found even remotely sort of kid friendly were the turtle ducks. Yeah. You know, there's a lovely landscape of cute animals, which is a great way to get me invested anywhere. Is if you show me a strange creature, I'm like,
they do very good animals. It's just putting two animals together. There's an owl cat in there. Yeah,
love to see it.
Yeah.
But that is like Game of Thrones grade.
Yeah. No, I feel like I picked, because definitely in isolation when it's your introduction, I probably picked some of like the deepest episodes to go into. So I feel like I really yeeted you into the like deep end. I think for me, actually, because a friend of mine is incredibly into Avatar. So I messaged him when I knew this was topic and was like, because I was shortlisting episodes and I had about 12 written down. And I was like, I cannot send them 12 episodes. So I was trying to pick about 4 and I shortlisted my 4, but I just messaged him and was like, look, if you were talking about Avatar, what episodes would you be like, I cannot leave these out? And he responded immediately with Zuko Alone and The Crossroads of Destiny, which were both already on my shortlist. So I was like, okay, you validated me. Thank you for this. But yeah, I think for Zuko in that moment, you know, you really get, and you only find out the truth of his backstory slowly over time. And even he doesn't know all of what happened until the very end. But you really get to see kind of how he became the angry person that he is in the early seasons, and see why regaining his honor and capturing the Avatar means so much to him. And then how that causes such a strong conflict with him when he suddenly, you know, like that, he meets that Earth Kingdom family and bonds with the younger boy. And then he saves them and the boy is just like, I hate you.
Yeah, looks him in the face and is like, get away from me. It's pretty hardcore.
It is devastating as well, because you can just see that, because even though he'd done something good for them, all they can see is that he is part of the Fire Nation and he is what they've feared their whole lives. And it's so heartbreaking to me to see him go through that, but then it takes him a long time to get there himself. Like, I think it's halfway through season 3 before he finally walks away from it. Yeah. And I haven't seen that in a children's show before. You know, I haven't seen that level of inward struggle, I think, from a character.
I mean, it came out, what, 2000?
2005, we said, was it?
Yeah, 2005 to 2008.
Like, that's a minute ago, right? And upon watching it again, because I would have seen flickers of it on Nickelodeon, like in the background of things. I think I was sort of maybe a couple of years older, so I never really gave it the time that I probably should have. But what really struck me about it was how serious it is. Like, that episode of Zuko Alone, like, he walks into this small Earth Kingdom town, which is fundamentally run by a tiny mafia.
It's very spaghetti western.
He kind of rolls in on the horse and like, it's really intense. And I was like, it's really gnarly. Like, and I don't know. I feel like, you know, kids are obviously big readers and enjoyers of high fantasy and complicated systems of power. But I just didn't expect it to be so dark in the way that it is.
Like, serialized kids TV shows weren't really a thing then. You know, I can't think of any other one that predates Avatar really that would have the space to do something like that.
Yeah.
To give, because in the very first episode, Zuko is just like this completely like stock villain who wants stuff at nothing to get the Avatar.
Yeah, and some asshole. Yeah.
And you're like 32 episodes later, like, Zuko, my child.
Oh, my sweet boy with sad face. Him in? Yeah.
Oh, my son. Yeah. But and it gets like, they don't pull back from the beginning. Like, you know, the opening episodes are very much scene setting, and it's, you know, you meet Katara and Sokka, they find Aang, Zuko arrives, so you really get that intro to all the characters. But even by quite early on in the season, you know, Aang visits the Air Temple where he grew up, and obviously he was there 100 years ago, and he finds the skeletons of the people he knew after they were massacred by the Fire Nation. Like,
gnarly.
It is pretty really gnarly. Intense. you know, and he's coming to terms with the fact that he ran away. And then that happened. And, you know, for him, he didn't want to be the Avatar. So he ran away.
Love a reluctant hero. Love a reluctant hero.
Oh, and like, he's both incredibly reluctant about it and like in some ways really wise, but then in other ways he's a 12-year-old kid and like he'll be there like, oh, I want to, like the first thing he does is ask Katara, will she go penguin sledding with him, and they get penguins and ride them like skateboards down a mountain. Like, and then on the other hand, he's wrestling with this massive destiny. So like, I think some of the episodes managed to be a lot more lighthearted or a bit more playful. And I think Sokka's a really playful character that kind of brings some levity sometimes, but the undercurrent of like the reality of what they're facing is always there. And I think it's in a way that I hadn't seen before in shows that I was watching.
I found Aang really surprising, because if you only know from like Netflix thumbnails or whatever, he's always like serious and glowing.
Yeah.
So when you introduce him and he's like this like goofy 12-year-old, like very goofy 12-year-old.
Kind of jarring.
Yeah, it is. And it totally made me be interested to see more. I was like, okay, I think I'm into this now from episode one. But also then when he has to deal with all this, the weight of all the decisions he has to make and all the things that have happened because of him or will happen if he doesn't do something, it feels so much heavier because he is just this goofy 12-year-old who has a crush on Katara, you know, and has a giant bison that he likes to ride around and like enjoys like inventing games with his airbending and not having to use it for saving the world, you know?
There's a really strong, I thought, bit in it where that they're one of the other prescription episodes where the was the end of season two, this two-parter, and he's sort of being visited by the long lineage of former avatars. And I thought that was really compelling, the idea of like him having to wrestle with the real serious destiny of being a person who has to heal a schism between these four nations in a very profound way. And like what it reminded me of was Steven Universe, this idea of this child who is on one hand a child but on the other hand is like, surprise motherfucker, you have to deal with this entire space opera of extremely complicated political interplanetary drama, which then lands upon your shoulders. And tempering good vibes and good telly watching with, like I said, Game of Thrones level political interpersonal drama is no mean feat, but I can see how it would swallow you up as a teenager because there's so much to get your brain around and so many places to be. Like the four tribes is, again, it's very, the sort of the science of children's storytelling is give a kid an option of four different places they can belong in, right? And that's how you situate your reader in a optional world, like certain magical schools, etc. None of these seem like happy places either, you know, which is compelling.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of giving people places to belong to, I have to ask, if you could pick a form of bending, what element would you choose?
I think I would do airbending.
You know,
flight just seems irresistible, you know.
The jump. Yeah. The thing glider. We can't do is jump.
Yeah.
I think having watched the Puppet Master episode, probably water.
Yeah.
I love that one. Yeah, I love that one. Yeah. Like that seems to me like a bottleneck episode wherein the sort of four kids wind up in a town and meet an ancient witch fundamentally who is like bad news, bad vibes, doing bad things. And she introduces, because, you know, this idea of controlling the elements or bending the elements is fantastic. Great way to translate magic. But the perspective that she takes on water bending is really cool, in that you can pull water out of just about anything, including people, referring to it as blood bending. And I was like, okay, now you're speaking my language. So unfortunately, I'm going to go the dark road and be like, I want to be out here pulling sweat and blood out of people's bodies. Sorry.
It's so, a very body horror episode.
Yeah, it's like, gross.
I think it's one of the most scary episodes that is there. And I think that's why I love, because that's why I had to pick it, because I think as well for Katara and her journey.
And she's lovely. What a sweet kid.
Oh,
you
she's
know?
So and
great
seeing,
hair.
Oh my God.
Great cartoon hair. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, for somebody who flies around on a bison all day, every day, I'm like, your hair is...
What a mane. Yeah. Like, love to see it.
Oh, but for her, like, having to wrestle with being given that power, and eventually she has to use that power to save her friends. And she breaks down in tears because she does not want that power. And she said, I choose not to use this. And then she had to. And, you know, again, it's just, I feel like everyone in the show has to make such in-depth moral choices.
What would your bending be?
Oh, water.
Yeah.
100% yeah. water. I'm like Cancer Sun, Cancer Moon, like love sea swimming. I'd be straight in the water.
I'm an Aquarius, so air, I'm air, my whole chart is air fully, but also like, I don't know, man, that it was that witch's perspective. There's this moment in that episode where they're standing in a field of flowers and she pulls all the water out of the flowers and leaves this hollow black circle in the soil. And I was like, yes, yes, this is correct. This is the way you want to kind of go. Like, it's fun.
It's interesting the way, like, definitely in the first season, probably most of the second season as well, you kind of think the fire, like they're like overpowered almost compared to the other ones. And it's only true, is it Ko is the earthbender?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Like, with the blue eyes.
Oh, no, Toph.
Toph, sorry, yeah. Like, so she realizes that, like, everything's kind of made of earth, so you can do metal as well. And then Katara realizes, like, everybody's made of water, so you can do water stuff as well. And then it's like, oh, fire is just destruction, whereas water and earth or air are, like, everything else. So, yeah, I guess the twist of it. I find really interesting.
Is it all of them? Owl House does this really well as well, where there's sort of schools of magic and different practices of witchcraft, and the real, truest, most dangerous form of all those. And again, why Aang is so powerful is this hybridization. And in the Owl House, why Ida, who's the owl lady or the practitioner of chaos magic, is very dangerous to the order of things, because when you realize that segregation of power doesn't work, everything on earth belongs to everything else, and it's only in harmonizing that you can truly gain, like, power. I don't know. I think there's a lot of, yeah, this is what I mean. There's a lot of meat in it. Like, it's not, on one hand, you're like, four tribes, four elements, but then you start looking closer, and very quickly it becomes apparent that they're not actually simplifying shit for you.
Yeah. No.
It's pretty hardcore.
And even like how for Aang himself, he needs someone from each of those places to help him get there. So, for him in season 3, he can't face the Fire Lord until he learns firebending, and he needs a firebending teacher. And then Zuko comes to help him finally. And it takes him and Zuko working together for him to eventually get into a place where he can challenge it. And they need, I think they all teach each other something, and they all learn from each other. Like, there's an episode where Aang is trying to learn earthbending, and earth and air are opposites, and he can't get his head around it, because as an airbender, his instinct is to, you know, deflect, avoid, like, stuff like that, jump around things. And for an earthbender, you have to root yourself and face things head on. And it's about him learning these different mindsets as well. So, like, you get a lot of, like, I learned a lot of life lessons from watching that show. I think especially Zuko's uncle Iroh, like, I just want him to follow me around and have tea with me and give me life advice.
Yeah, also a great way to peace out of a dynasty as well. I'll be like, sorry, I'm not doing it. I'm going to just drink tea and be a wise person. Peace. Like, that's the high road. Like, that's the road you want to go on, you know?
No, he's amazing. And I love his relationship with Zuko as well. Like, he is essentially Zuko's real father. Yeah. And that's what makes the Crossroads of Destiny so heartbreaking, when Zuko chooses to try and go back to the Fire Nation over his uncle. And like, every time I watch that episode, it breaks my heart. Even though I know what choice he's going to make, I'm still just like, maybe this time he won't do it. And, you know, I think there's just, I love the Iroh moments, because for so often he's comedic value. And then you get these glimpses of the power he has, because his backstory is that he was supposed to be the Fire Lord. He's Zuko's, like, dad's older brother, and when he was trying to take Ba Sing Se, his son was killed in battle and it broke him, and Zuko's dad used that as an opportunity to undermine him and take it. Yeah,
Game of Thrones shit, I'm telling you. Like, it's this is high political drama, you know?
It really is. Like, I mean, the manipulations and everything, like, it's so complex.
I love children's shows where you can see the adults milling around, and like, obviously a little bit of that is because how television works, that like, if you have a child watching TV, you generally have an adult knocking around. So the way these shows are run is so that the adults knocking around aren't bored to tears, you know. But this is, it feels very much like the things that are happening with the adults are not just background noise in service of entertainment. It's that the kids are literally products of the family dynasties and their problems that they come from. Like the chats that the waterbender whose name has gone out of my head.
Katara.
Katara has with the witch is about the witch being like one of the last southern waterbenders. And she's completely overwhelmed by the idea of never having met somebody else from her tribe who can do exactly what, who can show her the secrets and the legacy of a culture that has been destroyed, right? That is not chill Saturday morning viewing. That is gnarly. Like, that is much to think of and much to think about. So it really isn't a bunch of magical children frolicking around and saving the world at all.
And
like, it's really not.
They make it very clear as well that, like, these kids are dealing with the problems created by the older generation. Like, Aang at one point is in conversation with the previous avatars and the avatar is going, you are paying for my mistakes and you have to clean up my mess and I'm sorry for that.
Enjoy being 12.
Yeah.
Woof, like, yeah, yeah.
And like Zuko as well, you know, for him, it then falls on him to actually regain the honor of the Fire Nation by undoing the damage his dad and his granddad and his great-granddad have done. And like that for Katara, she is now the only southern waterbender left. Sokka's living up to the legacy of having a warrior dad and trying to, you know, live up to his expectations too. Like, all of them are dealing. And it's really interesting because just so often you have them, like, adults saying to them, like, yes, you are dealing with our mistakes. Or else, something I find really powerful is a lot of the time the adults, you know, because realistically, you know, you're watching this and you're like, you are 12, you are 14, get off that bison and go home. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. But all the parents and all the adults in the show don't try and stop them. They accept that they need to do this. And they actually just kind of give them signposts for the stuff they need to work out. And it's very enriching, I think. Like, obviously, then there's the antagonistic adults who aren't. But, like, people like Iroh, like Sokka and Katara's dad, who appears, you know, a lot in season 3. And a lot of time it's like, okay, yeah, you two need to go off with, like, even in season 1, their grand sends them off with Aang and they're like, yeah, this is what you need to do. You need to go help him. Off you go on his bison and hopefully I'll see you again at some point. And, you know, it's really lovely to see kind of all those adults helping them discover themselves.
It's the opposite of orphaning your primary cast and casting them to the wind, really, isn't it? That they are all handling, like, famously, that, again, more children's storytelling technique and murder everyone's parents off the bat. And so you give the child agency in the world without the pressures of parents. This is like the opposite of that.
Yeah.
It's Bree Waller. And as a writer yourself, like, how did you find that this brought you closer as a teenager, especially? Because this is obviously so when so many of us pick up the pen for the first time. Like, did you find that being so engrossed in this and loving this so much made you a creator yourself? Like, how did you find your way towards fiction? And was this a part of that road?
Yeah, like, I think I'd always loved writing and fiction growing, like, since I was a kid. Like, since I was old enough to know what a book was, I always wanted to write a book. But I think for me, Avatar really broadened my horizons on what you could do with the story. And I think, as well, like, for me, I'm a big elements person. So, like, the premise of the four elements and stuff like that, like, all that story building really drew me into it. But I think especially, I know I keep going on about Zuko, my surly son, but, like, his character arc blew my mind because I was like, oh, my God, you can write people like this. Mm. Like, this is, you can create this. And I think for me, it was just such, it was one of the most moving and emotional things that I'd watched. And I think just how much I loved all the characters and how strong a hold they had on my heart. I was like, oh my God, you can do this. Like, you can write things that make people feel this way. Mm. How do I do that? Mm-hmm. So definitely, I mean, for me, I always say that if I could ever write a character that has the same emotional effect on someone as Zuko had on me, like, then I think I'll just be like, I'm done. Like, yeah. Okay, I'm peaked. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not like I need to stop here now. But yeah, I just think it is such, I think it just really opened my eyes to what you can do with story and characters. And also that it can still be fun while you do it. Like, it's not,
Yeah, I recognize you're making it sound really gnarly and it's not, like, it's really not all doom and gloom at all, but I guess what struck me about it was its seriousness.
And I love that because you could easily watch the show and just laugh at the jokes and the mild peril and then
the cute animals,
the cool monkey.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, like Momo the lemur. And I would love an appa. Like if I had a sky bison, that would just be so delighted helpful.
With life.
So, yeah, yeah. So helpful as well. But yeah, you know, it's a fun world with, and they have these adventures that are a lot of fun too, but it's this undercurrent of, and the balance of that. And I think that's something that strikes me so much. The fact that it can be so much fun and also just then so emotionally devastating at times. So you're just like, oh, wait, can we go back to like the sky bison now? Like, I don't want to deal with this. But yeah, I think it's just, it's definitely one of the most formative, I think, stories that I remember kind of just really engaging with and just loving wholeheartedly.
And did you watch The Legend of Korra as well?
So any Avatar fans are going to be so mad at me, but I actually haven't. And I was talking to Alan about this before we start recording, where I loved Avatar so much that when Korra revisited that world, I was afraid to go back there because I knew some of the characters from Avatar were going to be in it. And it's a lot later on. I was like, what if they ruin it? Like, you know, and not even what if they ruin it, but just what if it's not what I imagined? And I think it's like, have you ever had that with like a piece of kind of pop culture that you were
talking
so
to
much?
The captain of not watching the end of TV shows because I don't know, I don't want to know what happens. Yeah. Like I am a notorious and aggressive unfinisher of things because I don't want, and I don't watch reboots. I watched the Twin Peaks last season because Lynch did it, and out of like respect almost for it, I tried to watch the X-Files reboot and was like, absolutely not, can't manage this at all. I've never watched the end of the original X-Files because I really just, I feel like the bottle of seasons 1 to 6 at a push, I would say even 1 to 3 are too perfect. Like, and I think that's a real powerful thing, is that watching and I hate describing it as like consuming media. It's an ugly way of putting it, but it is, you know, for the want of a kind of a more passionate frame of reference or frame of discussion, you don't have to complete something to have had a good time with it.
Yeah.
And for it to be meaning, you don't have to have meaning for you. You don't have to have seen everything of it for it to hold a place. And in fact, I completely relate to that. Like, I don't fucking want to know what they do with my gang later. I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to know what else. This belongs to me in this instance, and the way that it lives in me is almost not private but personal. So you don't need to watch the whole thing to be fulfilled.
And like a friend of mine was saying to me, you know, he was like, oh no, but like you should definitely watch Korra. Apparently like Azal's got a bit more queer rep, which I would love, because obviously Avatar is very cishet in it. Like it's, you know, there isn't a lot of queer representation in it, which I guess it was a children's show from 2005 to 2008, so I can understand it, but it's nice to see.
Coming up on 20 years ago.
Yeah. You know, so he was kind of saying that, and he was like, and Korra's brilliant. He was kind of explaining the premise a bit to me, and I was like, okay, I now really want to watch this, but also I'm afraid to go back into that world because I love Avatar so much, and I am just afraid of spoiling it a little bit. I had the same thing with the Philip Pullman books, you know, the His Dark Materials trilogy. I loved them so much as a kid.
Dark political thrillers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Apparently that was just my childhood.
Yeah.
Those books, like, I absolutely adore them. I read them a lot. Like, I'll reread them once every 1 to 2 years, but I still haven't read The Secret Commonwealth because Lyra's in it. And I'm like, no.
That's not your Lyra. Yeah.
I need to leave her on that bench in Oxford. Like, and just imagine how her life lived. I was like, I don't want you to tell me what happened. So I don't know if I'll ever be able to read that book.
That's really good. I think that's really good because you're protecting the intimate relationship you and your imagination have with these other spaces, which is the real death of the author moment, regardless of the intention of the creator or the intention of the industry that produces it. It becomes about you and your own relationship with these places and people. And a very non-completionist approach, I think, is important to have, you know, because you take it and it becomes yours and everyone else can fuck off. Like, you
know? The thing about Avatar is, though, that like some fictional universes just have one story in them.
Mm.
And when I was watching Avatar first, I was like, I can't understand how there's like a sequel series to this because it feels like it encompasses everything. But then I actually read what it was about and I was like, it's about like conflict between benders and non-benders and the tensions there once everything is peaceful again. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. There's something compelling there. But also the world building in Avatar is so good and detailed and there's so much thought into how each of these groups like use their powers in everyday life. Like the person they go to an Earth city and they have like a whole system like slides and like earth raised platforms bouncing stuff around the whole city. And then like they get to the first water city and like obviously everything is a canal. There's no roads. Because obviously it will be. That makes so much sense, you know? And like the fact that they have like demonstrations of their powers at festival days and stuff. And just the whole world feels completely thought through. Mm. And like it deals with like the big high level like themes really well. But also every single village they meet, they go to, feels distinct and thought through. And you feel you really get a feel of how ordinary people are dealing with these big world events everywhere you go. Like especially when you get to season 3 and they're in the Fire Nation. And the people in the Fire Nation are just living their lives and they're all normal people. Because they're not the aggressors. They're the aggressors. They're shielded from all the war stuff. Whereas in the Earth Kingdom and stuff, they're always a little bit in fear, a little bit on edge. Where Fire Nation are just ordinary people. And I found it resonant. Yeah, you know? Yeah, I was really blown away by... I love world building. Mm. I love if someone takes that extra step to go, how does this thing affect someone who isn't one of our main characters? Mm. How do just ordinary people deal with this? Like did you watch Disney Plus series Extraordinary?
No, but you're like the third or fourth person to mention it.
I'm evangelical about it. I love it. It's just about like everybody in the world gets superpowers when they turn 18, except this one girl who didn't. But the thought that goes into how that manifests in a world where everybody has powers, it's like, are superheroes a thing? Not really. So this guy who's trying to be a superhero is kind of a sad sack, you know, and that kind of stuff. I think I know they've set up like an Avatar studio now to like do lots of spin-offs. And it's like, on one hand, you're like, maybe. But like...
If you built the world and the world works.
I think it can hold it. I think
that world can
hold the stories. Yeah, I really do.
I think that I read The Power by Naomi Alderman approximately 5 years after everybody else did a couple of weeks ago. And it's still kind of knocking around my brain a bit because it does... It's about powers. It's about a world in which women specifically, it's very 2016, it's very binary. Women wake up one day with the power to just hurt each other with their hands. They get a new organ in their collarbone, like similarly to the things electric eels have in them. And they just fucking hurt people. And the way the world collapses and rebuilds upon this realization. Obviously, the world starts falling apart in a place in Moldova, which is the world capital of sexual slavery, and that's where the revolution begins. And it does this incredible job at showing in intrinsic detail how society collapses and how suddenly a matriarchy begins to very tightly resemble a patriarchy the second the power of violence falls to the other side. It's not a cheerful read. It's one of those things where it's like, how do I recommend? I don't know if I could recommend it whole-chestedly to people because some parts of it have dated, even in the short time that it's been out. And also, it's very violent. But I do really, really appreciate when you can see the intricacy of how someone is considered every single element of society and how it would be changed by magic.
World War Z is another example.
That's Copeland.
Where you hit every... No, it's Max Brooks.
I'm thinking Generation Z, sorry. Yeah.
Where they just hit zombies from every single possible angle, you know? And it's like, love it. I don't need a plot. I can just do world building.
I can hang out in this world.
Yeah.
And like, maybe that's what they can do with Avatar and those nations, is that they can continue to build it out. But you don't have to spend any more time there than you kind of can.
Yeah. Like, I think I'd almost be able to visit the world once they didn't talk about the characters that were in the world, so like completely new. You know, like, so that kind of thing, like I could almost imagine it as like almost kind of like in a Discworld style where like it's all the one world, but like each book is kind of like on different things, and that would be great. But definitely for me, yeah, I'm like, I don't want to know what happens to Zuko, Katara, Toph, Aang, Sokka. I don't want to know once that final credit comes down. Like, I'm happy.
I kind of want to know how it ends. But are you spoiled? You're going through it chronologically. I'm going to,
but I read the Wikipedia, so I would know what's going on. I know the final episode has a 9.9 on IMDb, so damn, I'm very excited about that.
That's high ratings.
That's uncommon.
Pretty phenomenal, except I do have one issue with how it ends. That is the hill I will die on, which is that Aang and Katara end up together, and I strongly believe they should not have. I think it should have been Katara and Zuko, because I love an enemies to lovers, and also how their relationship develops over the 3 seasons.
Do they age?
It's so authentic. Yeah. So it takes over about a year. So Aang is 13 when it finishes. Katara would be 15.
But he's also like 113, right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And Zuko's 16 by the end of it. And I think Sokka's the same age as Zuko. They never say what age he is, but I'm going to... They look around the same age, yeah, so we'll say that. And
he's older than Katara, but not old enough to go off to war with his father, so yeah. Let's assume, yeah.
And I know Zuko was 13 when he was banished from the Fire Nation, and he refers to it being 3 years.
Yeah, so you're cobbling together. Yeah, yeah, a little bit of time here.
But yeah, I feel like Aang and Katara together, it's kind of forced. And like you can see, like they see Aang having a crush on Katara from very early on, but it's never really explored, or just there's never really any inclination that she might feel. There's one or two episodes where you can kind of see her considering it, but like there's never a development. So it just feels really rushed at the end. Whereas she and Zuko have a whole journey in the third season where she's the one that doesn't want him to join the group. She doesn't trust him. She took what happened at the end of the Crossroads of Destiny where he turned on them really personally, because she's like, I was the first person to trust you and you betrayed us. She directs a lot of her anger about the Fire Nation and what happened to her mother at him. He's kind of the face of it for her. And there's a whole episode where the two of them go off together to hunt down the person that killed her mother and deal with that grief and that rage. And she goes off looking for revenge, and Aang is asking her, again, with the wisdom of a 113-year-old, you know, gives her like kind of monk wisdom and is like, revenge won't help you. Like, this isn't the way to do it. You need to try and forgive and move on. And she's like, no, like I want to hurt the person that killed my mother. And Zuko's like, hell yeah,
I would like to do a murder on this person immediately.
Zuko's always up for some murder, so he's like, I'll bring you.
I love murdering. Yeah, yeah.
But they have like this really beautiful adventure where Katara does, she gets there and she finds the person that killed her mother, and she can't do it. She's like, I don't want to be that person.
She can't take the water out of his body.
She does use it on him a little bit.
Just out of his eyes maybe or something.
But like she doesn't go through with it. And when she gets back, she's like, and Aang's like, oh, you chose forgiveness. She's like, oh, I'll never forgive him. But like, I just couldn't murder him. But then she's like, but I can't forgive you to Zuko, because she can see how he's trying to change, and they have all these moments. And I just would have really loved to see if she had to end up with anyone. I mean, they could have just not had romance, but like, you know, if she's going to end up with someone, then I think Zuko just feels like natural.
I kind of like it when things don't always work out for, like, I get that with some things sometimes where I'm kind of rooting for a couple or whatever, and I really want things to work out. Succession starts back on Monday, guys, just in case. It'll probably be long out by the time where I'm kind of sitting there being like, ready to fucking go back to hell. But I know that a lot of the couples I'm rooting for in telly are never going to get together, or things won't work out the way that I want them to, because that is for me and my brain. And I love that sometimes where, again, it's that thing, it feels like it belongs to me. This is something that I feel about it. This is a story that I am telling myself while I'm letting this other story inhabit me. So even when it's like, script writers made a bad call there, it doesn't matter, because it still belongs to you. It still like lives in here, you know.
Me and most of Tumblr, I think the Zutara fandom is like,
God, I love Tumblr. The best place on the internet. It's just completely lawless, completely unhinged, and it's where people can go to play these things out, which I think is so powerful and so lovely to watch. I think I've been on Tumblr for like, say 16 years or something horrifying like that. Jesus Christ, half my life. And I think it's really special then, because maybe we weren't given exactly what we wanted, but we made it ourselves, which is better, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I mean, if that's the biggest issue you have with how a show of that proportion ends, I think it's pretty okay to be like, oh, he didn't end up with the person I wanted him
Resolving a four-continent political fucking disaster.
Honestly, the story building, the arc, and I think it's because they went into the show knowing it would be three seasons.
Yes.
It's one season per element. So the first one's about water, then earth, then fire, because Aang already has air when he's introduced. And I think for
the Is there writing, an air nation?
They've been genocided.
Oh, they've been genocided. Yeah. Okay.
So all the temples are empty, and Aang is the last one. But yeah, I think it's so tightly written because they knew they had those arcs. They didn't try to drag it out, and it was so well received. They could have very easily gone, oh, actually, like, let's do 6 seasons. And I'm so glad that they just kept it to 3 and were like, nope, here's what he needs to do. Here's the objectives. Here's how we're going to get there, because it feels fresh. And like, you're left wanting more when it finishes.
Which
and
is I a good think, feeling. Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's so important, I think, to have that feeling, whereas I think a lot of the time with shows that are very popular, they drag them out for 8 seasons, and then by the end you're just like, you know, there's only so many things they could do and then so many roadblocks they could throw at them before.
Like, I think I'm just going to start pretending that Stranger Things is a 1 season show. Do you know that? So I'm just going to be like, nah, I'm never, this is there a 2nd season? Never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about. Is there a 4th season? I don't know, never heard of it. 1st season's perfect. I don't know why we're in fucking Russia for half the 3rd one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it feels sometimes as though they are really just trying to wring cash out of people instead of trying to tell an elegant story with popular television. Like, maybe we know this.
Yeah.
You know, intellectual property franchise, even the language of it, like you said, consuming media, etc. Like, when you're being overfed something, it loses its taste immediately. And shorter is better. Small and complete is better than sprawling, messy and well, actually, is it? I don't know. I agree with you on the whole, is that sometimes a good story can be told and then we're done here.
Yeah.
Rather than just yeeting it out forever for no reason.
Yeah. And I think definitely with how the episodes are structured and stuff, I think they would have run out of things for them. Like, there's only so many times they can have a conflict and then just about escape it and then move on.
Are there fluff episodes? Like, beach episodes? No, they're not actually beach episodes.
There is a beach
like,
episode.
Is there a beach episode? Yeah, beach I love a fluff episode. I think about this with Sailor Moon a bit. Me and Kerry watched a lot of the original season of Sailor Moon when we were living in America, because they used to drop 2 episodes at a time on Hulu on Monday nights. So that was our Monday night, was watching an hour of Sailor Moon. And obviously that has a plot, but also has a lot of fucking around at the mall. And the fucking around at the mall episodes are really critical because they make you care about who everybody is. And it's the monster of the week and the X-Files. It's how you get drawn. Adventure Time is great for this, you know, where you just have set pieces. But I think they bring you closer. They make you genuinely care about the characters in a way, because you just see them kind of inhabiting their lives. And that's what I would want to. That's what I felt about that Puppet Master episode, where it felt to me like I really liked the one about Zuko. I found the double barrel at the end of season 2 a little bit hard to keep track of because I was learning quickly. But I found those singular episodes, like that spaghetti western vibe of coming in out of a town, like the perfect character portrait, like a really, really perfect character study on somebody. And then the Ghosty episode was also a perfect character study and also sad as hell. And those little singly episodes are the ones that I think I would be looking for rather than the plot ones. Do you know what I mean?
No, there's a lot, I think. Alan, do you find that, because obviously you're watching it for the first time? So
yeah, like we were saying this beforehand, like there's a lot of characters who are introduced like once and it feels like they're going to be huge, and then you just do not see them again.
Aww.
There's an amazing bounty hunter who comes in for one episode, and she has it like a giant blind dragon dog who sees by smell, who tracks them basically across the entire continent. And she's so cool, first of all. I was like, if I watched this as a child, my type would be different.
Yeah, yeah. Thing, oh, you know? Look at this transformative moment I'm having. Oh.
And she's so well developed that it feels like they're really setting her up to be something. And then she comes back maybe once in season 3.
Yeah, wow. She turns up again. Yeah. So like, there is a lot of characters that they meet along the way that then turn up again in season 3. So like for the big showdown,
they're building
all the friends
return.
But like that, I think they're almost so good at building characters that it means that all these one-off characters that you get, you're like, no, I want more. Mm. Like, can they come back? So like,
they don't feel like one-offs because they're so well developed. It feels like it's all part of a larger thing heading towards something. So even though it is standalone, like the other episode you picked up, you haven't talked about it at all, where Sokka's master.
Oh, the sword. Yeah.
Where, again, that sword master is
totally incredible. Complete. Yeah. That's somebody's whole ass life that we are just dropping into and dropping out of that is operating while we're not watching.
Yeah. And like, I tried to pick as well, like, episodes that kind of gave you that snapshot of people. Mm. Like, I feel like I did, like, Toph dirty because she didn't really get, like, an episode that's all about her. But Sokka's master is one of my all-time favorite episodes because, kind of like you were talking about Extraordinary there, Alan. Like, for me, something growing up that I've always such a soft spot for is the one character in the gifted group of people that isn't special.
Oh, the one shit one. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I was always like, I would be the shit
one. Same.
Like,
I'm just kind of shit. Yeah, yeah.
The person that doesn't get a destiny.
Talking about a person who's hanging out with novelists all the time. I'm like, look at all these people who are gifted kids. And I'm like, oh, not me, man. I'm a shit one. Like, easy peasy, you know?
So, yeah. So like for me, I think Sokka's someone that like, I really am like, I would be you. Like I would 100% be the one. Like I want to be Katara. I want to have bloodbending and turn things into ice and be able to heal people. But I'm definitely going to be Sokka. And for me, something that I really love about him is that he gets to grow over the three seasons too. He develops skills. He is so important to the group. He's the strategist. He's the ideas person. And the fact that he got this episode where at the beginning, it's so hard for him because there's this fire and the others are all pointing it out. And he's like, what can I do? And they're like, oh, you can't do anything. You can't bend. And he just has to sit there and he says to them after, he's like, all of you are special and I'm not. And it's really hard. And even though they try to, like, they kind of bolster him a bit, but also go, but we understand why you feel this way. And then they're like, let's help you feel better. And, oh, hey, there just happens to be a really gifted swordsman up the road. Like, why don't you go study with him? And apparently Sokka becomes a gifted swords fighter in a day. For plot, but yeah.
they didn't need to explicitly say that it had been a day.
Yeah.
They could let us think it was a few weeks.
Yeah. But like he's like he gets one day and suddenly he's amazing. But I love that because you see how important he is to the group when he's not there and how much they miss him. But also he gets to show off again what skills he has in his own right. And for me, like I think definitely, like when I was growing up, before I realized how problematic he was, like I loved Xander and Buffy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Before rewatch, because again,
none of us could
reason.
Think critically as teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
Again, every so often in Juvenile, I'm like, I'm going to put the little bookmark up and be like, it was a very different time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We really only have critical language now.
Yeah.
All our faves are problematic. We haven't said that in a while, but all our faves are problematic. I will not expect my teenage self to have been smart. Was really dumb. That's fine. That's totally fine.
It's like I started watching Buffy and I was like 9 or something.
Come on.
Like, I did not have the critical thinking. But there's a speech from season 7 of Buffy that makes me think of that episode with Sokka where Dawn thinks she's a slayer potential and then finds out she's not. And Xander gives her this speech at the end and he's like, they will never know how hard it is to be the one person in this group that is not special. But like, I see you, I see how amazing you are, I see how you put this work in and stuff like that. And that really reminds me of Sokka. And I think that's why I love that episode so much because, you know, he's all throughout the story, it is made so clear that he is just as essential to the others as he is, as like Aang is, as Katara is. But seeing him address that insecurity and going, I'm surrounded by the world's most gifted waterbender, earthbender, and the Avatar. So surprisingly, I get a bit insecure.
And even the stickhead who keeps showing up is a fucking prince firebender. So yeah. Like, what am I supposed to do here? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And then he gets to kind of feel empowered in his own right. And even for season 3, he's behind the military strategy for when they invade the Fire Nation. And he comes up with a strategy for the final battle. Like, he has amazing skills too, but,
just in a different
you know, way. That episode is like him getting to realize that. And I think, again, as the person who would be the not special person, like the shitty one of the group, I was like, oh yeah, you do it for us. You do it for like the normie people who, you know,
non-magical motherfuckers. Yeah.
We can do stuff. We can read a map. I can't read a map.
But it's also about, like, you know, talent and stuff isn't innate for all of us. Sometimes some of us had to work a little bit harder and go a little bit of the longer road that might have been a bit more wonky. And it doesn't matter. You can still be useful. You can still be helpful. Mm. You know? Yeah.
Like, the story of Avatar is about, like, Aang. It's supposed to be, like, learning about the four elements. But there is, like, a fifth element, which is the null, the one that can't do anything.
Yeah.
And it's really about he needs to unify all four tribes. But there is a fifth tribe of everybody else who doesn't have this power.
Yeah.
And Sokka is that person in the group. So, I
think it's fifth element in
exactly
the movie, the fifth element.
The sword. Yeah.
It's just people. It's humanity. Okay. So it is as important. There's your throwback Juvenile episode 1, 7 years in, fifth element. But like, it is a, I don't know, it's got a lot of, it's like, I know I keep saying the word serious, but it does have a huge amount of heart. Like, it feels very, and like, you know, like Steven Universe is sincere almost to a fault where you're a bit like, okay, let's dial it back a bit. But there's a seriousness and a classic feel to it. It feels like, again, it is like an early 20-year-old TV show, but it feels like a story that's older than that, almost. you know, it feels like it's a kind of an eternal tale.
Yeah.
And I think that's very powerful that it hasn't dated. That's actually something.
Yeah.
We often go back to TV shows in the past and we're kind of holding onto our chair and going, okay, yikes. But this doesn't feel dated at all. It feels completely modern and completely timeless.
I guess it's not doing like references.
Yes, you know? I love that.
I know
that.
We use the same as a spaghetti western episode. What it's like, spaghetti western is not like a, no. It's not like a Pulp Fiction episode, you know?
Yes.
And
that's thematic and stylistic, and it doesn't even direct. It's not even directly like yeehaw cowboy hat. It's a person driving it down on a horse, like that. Or not. He's not even a horse. Is it? Is he on a thing? A creature?
An ostrich.
Yeah. And I think that timeless quality and really the writing is so good because it's not leaning on the early 2000s.
And the design as well. The tribes are also very clearly defined. I know it's a lot of Chinese influences and Siberian influences,
which is lovely to see. It's really interesting and really beautiful, like real lush to see. Like,
I think visually it's gorgeous, but then like that, I think definitely the issues they're dealing with are timeless, and the way they address them aren't rooted in that period of time for us. So like you say, it's easier to come back and watch it and not cringe a little at it. Like even when the episode deals with sexism, Katara gets to the Northern Water Tribe and is like, yeah, I can't wait to learn waterbending with Aang. And they're like, oh, women aren't allowed waterbend, you can only heal. And she is obviously really annoyed about it, ends up challenging the master to a fight and earning the right to learn how to waterbend alongside the men. But even like that, she is, again, it's a show for children and she's dealing with systematic racism and patriarchal values and stuff, and it, like, obviously it's all very well dealt with in one episode, which is, you know, I wish everything could be dealt with in that way, but it's really amazing to see all of that and see how all of these really complex topics that I think are still very much relevant today are being brought up in a children's show from
and then it's not hitting you. It's not hitting you over the head with it. Mm-hmm. It's not like, and we're going to learn a lesson about imperialism today, kids. It's not like that at all. It's all in the machine of the storytelling, which is just so elegant.
Yeah, and like, I think it definitely has just so much heart as well. Yeah. I mean, like, especially, I mean, some of the life advice Iroh gives. I mean, I was watching an episode where he's talking, he meets Toph along the road and Toph is blind, so doesn't know he's a Fire Nation person, and sits down and has tea with him. And he says to her, like, it's not weak to let the people who love you take care of you. And I was just like, oof, like, okay, I just sat down to watch like some TV for a podcast. I didn't expect to get like, you know, an emotional lesson. Yeah, like, thanks. But, you know, stuff like that. And I'm sitting there watching it like, again, I would just really like an Uncle Iroh to follow me around and give me life wisdom and tea, because he makes really good tea.
Impromptu hot tubs as well. Mm-hmm. It's a good Fire Nation trick. Any water is a hot tub if you're Fire Nation.
That's true.
That would be a good skill.
Yeah. The episode where they get to the Northern Temple is where I realized I was like completely in hard on the show. Because when the guy said to Katara, oh, women can't waterbend, in a room on my own, I went, oh no. I was like, okay, you know, this show's got into me. Yeah, I'm in.
It is devastating.
It really is. Like, there's been like 18 episodes where Katara's kind of the main character in season one. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually definitely the point of view character. So, and you just kind of take it for granted that this is where we're heading, this is what's going to happen. And then it's suddenly like, no, we're very sexist up here. I'm sorry.
But yeah, and I think Katara is a really amazing character as well, because something I love about her is she has a temper.
Mm.
She has an ego. Like, she gets really jealous when Aang starts picking up waterbending faster than her, and it makes her steal a waterbending scroll so she can continue to improve, because she spent ages self-teaching herself, and then when she shows it to Aang, he gets it in two goes, and she gets really like jealous of him, and you know, she gets angry a lot and stuff. And I love seeing that as well, that she's not just like, she's also like got a lot of heart and she's really kind, she keeps everything together, but like, she also has moments where she completely loses her temper and is just like, I'm done with all of this. And I love seeing that as well, because, you know, I like angry women.
She also makes an enormous fuck up with hanging out with that mean ghost lady, though, like, as well, because the others are genuine, like, oh, I'm not so sure about this weird old lady. There's a lot of superstition and I don't know about this. This feels a bit off to me. And she's like, fuck off. I'm going to go with my ancestor here. And she's wrong. She's nakedly wrong and gets herself into a dangerous situation. So, Yeah, she's cool.
Yeah, she's cool. Brilliant. I like her. Yeah. And so I like about her as well, she's someone who from the very first episode, she won't turn her back on someone who needs her help. And it's something that comes up again and again during the season where she will push to be the one helping out, like, the ordinary people on the way. And she'll be like, I can't leave this village until it's free from this, like, group of people, or these people's river has been polluted. I can't leave until it's clean. And she's really stubborn, but, like, in a, like, kind of almost angrily loving way that I find really refreshing. But yeah, I like how all of them throughout the show make a lot of mistakes. And it's a show that really talks about the fact that you can make mistakes and you can't always fix the mistake, but you can apologize and move on. Like, Zuko is a great example of that, but because he makes so many mistakes all the way along. And then he, by season three, he's doing everything he can to make up for it. And it's kind of something where it's like, you can't take away your past actions, but you can move forward and do the right thing moving on, and then hopefully that will help. And I think that's a really nice message. But again, like you say, they're not hitting you over the head with it. They're not like, okay, and now this week's episode is about redemption.
Yeah, it doesn't feel moralistic at all. It just feels like a very nuanced, complicated story that just happens to be put together in a way that's showing you. I was interviewing a writer last week on the road. I was chairing a conversation with Victoria Schwab, and she builds big complicated worlds with incredible elegance. And something that she said about the way that you can show, or the way she prefers world building, and I really agree with this as someone who is a terrible world builder. I'm just like, I'm out here fucking throwing down runes and hoping for the best. But what I feel like I learned, and this is a really good example of that, is a world where you don't, if a fictional world is a house, you don't just want to walk your person in, your reader in, and show them where the kitchen is, the bathroom is, the bedroom is, and show them all the limits and the boundaries and everyone who lives there, and then close the door behind them when they're done. What you want to do is bring them to a window and show them the house through the window and all the people moving around through the window, and then walk away. Because that house is still running, you know, while even after you've left. It's still happening independently of you. There's no total resolution. There's no complete limit. You haven't seen the back wall and the ceiling and all the corners. The rest is running and humming away, and you trust that it functions from a distance. I am butchering these analogy here, but I think that this is a really good example of a world that you only see a sliver of. And like you said about those fully rounded characters, like the swords person or the bounty hunter, who you only see for a moment, but you are sure that when they leave the screen, they're still going. And like in Zuko's episode with that Earth Kingdom town, that town is still rolling after he leaves on his ostrich. You know, like, there's a real confidence in how everything is built. It's not, it is neat, but it's not finished, if that makes sense. It still feels like it's running away on its own steam. And that's what I mean when I say it's serious. What I actually should be saying is that it's very sophisticated, in that it's very clearly we're only seeing through one window.
I remember a point in season one where I can't remember exactly what it was, but I was like, I remember thinking, they are executing this at such a high level. For a kids show, it's really kind of breathtaking.
Feel like a kids show.
It doesn't, does it? Yeah.
No, not at all. It feels like, I mean,
well, except on like Nickelodeon, where every episode starts with a kid skateboard.
Oh my god, yeah, it's traumatizing. It's really upsetting. God, Nickelodeon. It doesn't. And it feels to me maybe like the kind of, again, elegant and sophisticated fantasy story that could only be told through animation, because you're depicting, and thank God they're not CGIing it, though I'm sure we will.
They're doing a live action.
I knew it.
I'm not watching it.
I like how we just pretend the film doesn't exist.
Embrace tradition. Embrace tradition. Refuse maternity. Fuck CGI. Fuck your green screens. Yes. Yeah, like, tell us how you really feel. Oops. Oops.
No, I think if you were like reading descriptions of how all these cities work, you'd be like, all right, okay. But just like seeing it happen in the background of stuff, and just letting the world breathe building around the characters, yeah, works really well in animation. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to watch the whole thing now.
Yeah,
cozy,
yeah.
Cozy up to it.
And I would say anybody who feels like we spoiled a lot of stuff,
we really probably,
my experience of it was I watched all of season one, and then one episode from the middle of season two finale, and then two from the middle of season three, which were the ones Amy recommended. When I went from end of season one to the Zuko episode, I was like, I didn't feel spoiled. I was like, How does he get to here? And we want to know the in-betweens. And then when you get to the end of season two, where Zuko is working in a tea shop and it seems totally calm and cool and just like a very happy boy with his uncle.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't feel spoiled. I feel like the journey really, really matters in this show.
Yeah.
And that's much more important than big plot points. It's about the journey with this. It really is a journey.
Mm-hmm.
So, Amy, do you, if someone listens to this episode and they're really excited about an Avatar episode and they were like, I can't believe she didn't talk about what? What haven't we talked about?
Yeah, what are we missing? Yeah.
Oh, God, I mean, I feel like there's just so much in the show that I think we could probably sit here for about 5 hours, you know, and like, Azal, like, I'm obviously, I've seen all of them, like, I've seen some of them, and Sarah, you've seen four of them, and I still feel like we can get enough out of that to keep talking about it. But I think actually something about the show is there's definitely going to be people listening to this going, I can't believe you didn't talk about this, because that is the beauty of the show, is that there are so many small details and so many characters and so many moments. Like, I feel like I could definitely go on about Iroh's arc a lot more. I think there's just so much in it that everyone's going to be listening to this and going, can't believe you didn't talk about this. And if that's the case, then do come talk to me about it, because I will happily nerd out about it. But like, I think for me, definitely the stuff we've been talking about is the stuff that I love the most about it. But there's just so much in it that I don't think you can cover it in one episode.
Yeah, we were saying this beforehand, like, it's either we've done like a pretty decent dive into it, but you really need to go episode by episode and maybe start a new podcast where we talk about that. Maybe.
Pod Nation.
Like. Yeah. Amy Clarkin, thank you so much for bringing Avatar into our lives.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you liked it. Yeah. I was really worried when you said you hadn't seen it. I was like, I really hope they don't hate the show.
No, not at all. It's like a really, that's a really nice thing about Juvenilia, is that it's often an excuse for us to finally watch things that we have been on the periphery of over the years. Again, like, we're,
it felt like the Eerie Indiana episode where it was like, oh my god, haven't seen this.
It's been sitting there this whole time. Like, it's the, we've hit a big landmark with Juvenilia recently in that we're 7 years old, and like, when I think about all of the different things that we have finally gotten the chance to watch that we've been dancing around in culture for literally 7 years. It's lovely to add something new to the catalogue that feels like, oh, there's going to be 2 weeks where every night I sit down and I watch three episodes of this and I feel very warmed in my heart about it. So thank you for bringing it to us.
I've definitely learned like so many. I was saying to Tom before we start recording that, like, because obviously I've been a long time Juvenilia fangirl since back in the beginning. And the amount of different pop culture things that I've discovered through, because my favorite thing is hearing people talk about things they love enthusiastically.
Oh, look,
so
same.
The amount of things that I've discovered from listening to episodes, and then like, I'm part of the way through Terry Pratchett's Discworld books now because I listened to your episode on it and was like, okay, I need to read these books. So I think it's really lovely hearing people talk about things they're excited about. Because I feel like that's not something we actually get a chance to do a lot at the moment.
Enthusiasm is really important.
And earnestness. Like, I feel like I'm a very earnest person in a world that isn't always forgiving of, or I think cynicism is kind of more what we err towards. So getting just to come on and earnestly nerd out about the show that I love and had so much fun rewatching for this was just so much fun.
Well, thank you for bringing it to us. I'm excited.
Speaking of things to get excited about, tell us about your book.
Yes.
When's it out?
So my debut book, What Walks These Halls, is out on the 10th of April with the O'Brien Press. It is a YA horror about a team of paranormal investigators investigating a haunted house in a fictional town in Wicklow, in case anyone from Wicklow reads it and thinks I think it's a real place. So basically, Raven and Archer's dad died during a paranormal investigation of Hyacinth House. Raven doesn't remember what happened, but she's pretty certain it's her fault. Her brother Archer is desperate for answers, so when he's asked to investigate the house, he agrees, even if Raven wants nothing to do with it.
It was very exciting.
So yeah, it is spooky, has queer rap, disability rap, found family. I had a lot of fun writing it, and I hope people will enjoy reading it. So that is out April 10th.
That's only around the corner. Fantastic.
So soon, terrifying.
Yeah, spring releases. Love it.
And where can people find you online? So I'll follow you.
So I'm on Twitter at Amy Clarkin, but I don't use Twitter as much. So mainly Instagram at Amy Clarkin Writes.
It's dead.
There we go. Sarah, where can we find you?
I'm still on the damp sinking ship. of twitter.com@Grifsky. My Instagram is Sarah Grifsky, and my newsletter, which has taken the place of my Patreon, is griffnotes, like cliff notes, .ghost.io. Other Words for Smoke and Spare and Fan Parts are available in all good bookstores, and I will have news regarding future projects very soon. Alan, where can we find you?
I am Alan_McGuire on the failing app. And
the sinking ship.
Alan Instagram. Instagram? What the hell is that? I was so edgy. Juvenalia is Juvenalia_pod on Twitter and Juvenalia_pod on Instagram. We have Patreon where we talk about stuff we started and finished recently. It's very fun.
Yeah. You should come and hang out at our Patreon. It's a lot of fun. Me and Alan have beers and play each other's songs off our phones, which is more fun than it sounds. We talk about, it's mostly a video games podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And probably will be Succession talk, I would say, quite soon as well.
Yeah, so stick around there for my for how I really feel, for some real talk.
Honestly, we once put an episode up on our main feed, and I had to cut out some serious amount of Succession stuff just to
see. How tall is Kieran Culkin? We don't know, and we don't care.
thank you to Dean McDonald for artwork.
Thanks,
Dean. Thank you to Cassie Delaney.
Oh, thanks, Cassie.
For recording us and having us.
Yeah.
Thank you again to Amy Clarkin.
Thanks,
and
Amy.
We'll see you in 2 weeks, everybody.
See
you,
everybody. Bye.